Welcome to episode 4 of the 1987 WNBC radio documentary, The New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons. I'm Bud Mishkin. This is a 9-episode series that I originally wrote and produced and created in 1987, voiced by my then WNBC radio colleague Gary Bridges, about one of the most beloved teams in American sports history, the New York Knicks of the late 60s and early 70s. In episode 3, we relived the dramatic 1969-70 season when the Knicks won their first NBA title in franchise history. The team was beloved for how it played as a team on the court, but fans quickly understood that this Knicks team was a compelling cast of characters off the court. That's the subject of episode 4 of The New York Knicks, Those Championship Seasons.
The New York Knicks' first championship in 1970 was something different for everyone. For New York Times boxing analyst Phil Berger, it was the opportunity of a lifetime, maybe a present from the powers that be. Phil was working on his own that year and had chosen to chronicle the season in a book. It became The Miracle on 33rd Street.
If one were a novelist creating a fictional team with pronounced personalities, I couldn't have done better than this Knicks team. You know, you had a Willis Reed, a kind of strong man's man, Bill Bradley, a Rhodes Scholar, a Dick Barnett, a kind of sly and droll character. Fraser sort of was part of that, the 19 late 60s, early 70s mod style of dressing, and your kind of flashy hero type. And the Busher, your blue-collar, old-fashioned athlete, more with the values of the late 40s, 1950s, kind of Norman Rockwell Saturday Evening Post covers.
Clearly, it was a team of characters. Cassie Russell.
We were considered, at the time, fairly intelligent ball players. We knew what our roles were. We respected each other's ability to deny self and be ready to give of yourself to be a winning combination is what I really liked about playing with the Knicks.
Willis Reed.
You had a team of great personalities and with the Knicks because of the Busher and the things he had done in his life and the stirred mistakes of Frazier and Bradley and Reed and Russell, Stallworth, Mike Ridd, and how he made it in the NBA and the Dave Stallworth and his problems he had with his health coming back to play. And I think because of Red Hoseman and the kind of basketball he had been accustomed to and played as a young man growing up learning the game, we were a team that most people enjoyed watching because there was always consistent teamwork on both ends of the floor, offensively and defensively.
Even other teams recognized that something special was going on in New York. Celtics guard JoJo White.
The ball was being placed around and moved around where everybody is involved. Now, it makes for a happy team because nobody's under the pressure of having to bear the burden of carrying the club night in and night out. It falls on all of them shoulder, and they approach the game that way.
Baltimore Bullets forward Jack Maron.
They took the best of their own parts. They sacrificed each of their own parts, and they sacrificed some of their own maximum individual performance to get a maximum team performance.
Walt Frazier says as hot as the Knicks were on the floor, they were just that cool off it.
We weren't a rah-rah team. guys weren't that excitable. And, we go out, we win the games, and that was it. You know, we drink a few beers, we relax, we get ready for the next game.
But Phil Berger knew the team's quiet style of confidence.
They'd laugh about kicking butt. They'd be boasting's not quite the right word, but they'd be having fun with it. Did this to that guy, did that to that guy, and they had certain sort of insider terms that they'd use, and it would mean nothing to a stranger who'd walk in, but it had a kind of meaning to them if they said certain key words. It would be like blowing their horn. Mm-hmm. So they'd go, you'd walk into the locker room and they'd be singing out or crooning those words, and what they'd be saying was, we're the best, we're the best.
Dave DeBuscher.
I think it was unique, and I say uniqueness is it was unique in a way that I thought we were not the most gifted bunch of athletes in professional basketball put together on one team. We were without question the smartest group put together, and I think we probably had more pride than anybody else.
Walt Frazier remembers the guy they called the captain.
Willis Reed, to me, was a guy that short on talent, but no one would ever out-hustle him, and that's why he was so great. Because he couldn't jump that high. He was a good shooter for an outside player. He wasn't that fast, but he had heart, man. The guy had so much determination.
Even a Boston loyalist like Celtics broadcaster Johnny Most had to love Willis Reed.
A guy who was whose performance was greater than his ability, and because he had that kind of a furnace fire burning inside of him, where he was just a super, super competitor. And, I mean, he was a guy who was only like 6'9", 6'10", at the most. And he was playing against big horses. The big trees were out there even then.
Dave DeBuscher may have been the catalyst. He was certainly the addition that put them over the top. But he was also an unusual guy who wasn't satisfied with being an NBA star. In his early years with the Pistons, he'd finish the NBA season and then go off to pitch Major League Baseball.
There wasn't quite the schedule that there is today, and the seasons didn't quite overlap like they do. And it was easier for somebody to play two sports. And I did for 4 years. I played 4 years of baseball with the Chicago White Sox, and at the same time I was playing with the Detroit Pistons. And I'd go from one sport to the other, and it was very exciting, actually, because I was single, and I was going around the country seeing cities I'd never been to before. And it didn't really have the conflict that you would have now.
DeBuscher settled on playing basketball, but soon took on the additional duties of coaching his Detroit Piston team.
There's no question in my mind I was not mature enough to handle it. However, it was presented to me in a fashion that it would just be on a very short interim basis until a permanent coach could be found. Well, we started to win a few games, and interim became permanent in a sense, although every coach is on an interim basis. But it lasted 2.5 years. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't like it. I felt that, do as I say, not as I do was very difficult.
Marv Albert remembers DeBuscher for his unbelievable determination.
One game that Dave played sticks out in my mind, and more so than any playoff or championship. It was an exhibition game at the Garden, and Julius Erving was with the Nets, and it was the first time. This is right after the merger agreement. I think it was the year before the leagues were to merge, but then they agreed they'll start with exhibition games. Mm-hmm. And here was one of the finest defensive forwards going up against the superstar, the Doctor, and Dave shut him down. It just took him out of the game. It was extraordinary. I broadcast the game with John Andres, and it was just extraordinary to watch, because he just kept the ball away from him, would not allow him to have the ball. And I know how much it meant to Dave to cut Julius down.
I was sort of known as a defensive player, and here comes Julius in, who I admired tremendously. And I said, God, it was like any time you study a player. I remember watching Julius, who was at that time young, so he didn't have all of the different characteristics on the floor that he does, that he did really in his basic prime. And I always remember, I said, well, if he drives right, he's always going to come back to his left. And I said, so the first time he does it, I'll just run out and take a chance. Mm-hmm. And I did, and I blocked his shot, and we went the other way. I mean, and the Garden went crazy. It was just a chance. Now, if he was a little early, he would have faked me. I'd have been on the seats, and he'd have dunked the ball. And, we go the other way, and then they forget about all that. Jeez, did he show that old guy up?
Dave DeBuscher's partner in the front court was Bill Bradley.
He had a rough time breaking in because he started out as a guard handling the ball. And I recall he really cost the Knicks some games early, which you'd expect. He was a rookie, even though he was a very smart player. And it took a while before he fit in. I mean, he was, again, on a very special team, just part of the puzzle, who complimented DeBuscher and Reed and Barnett and Frazier. And finally, when the DeBuscher trade was made, they were great for each other.
Red Holtzman.
We set a lot of things up for him because he was such a great shooter. Mm-hmm. You know, if we got him the open shot, he'd make it. And He was very, very, he's one of the smartest guys we had, you know. I mean, as far as knowing the game and loved to play team basketball, that was, you know, that's the only way he wanted to play. That's the only way he knew how to play.
Knicks announcer John Andres.
What turned you on as a viewer, as a spectator, was watching the ball go to his hands and go to the open man next, because he did it in a very characteristic fashion that we don't see today. It moved in and out of his hands so quickly. And that's what's fun to watch, that ball move, because the defense can't keep up with that. And that's the fun, watching teamwork exploit defense.
Bill Bradley was a good shooter, tough on defense, and a great passer. But as a player, Bill Bradley was something else.
He also, by the way, with all due respect, I think was, to a great degree, somewhat dirty in his play. I mean, he would be described that way. With great respect, considering who he is today, you know. But I'll tell you, if you or I or anybody listening to this would have to be guarding Bill Bradley or being played by him, I'm sure there'd be a lot of rolling on the floor before that relationship was done.
And Leonard Lewin says Bradley took a scientific interest in the game.
Just before every game, they give him the game ball. And people used to wonder why. Why would he have... He was testing the weight. He was the ball tester, the official ball tester for the Knicks. He just squeezed the ball. And you know how much pounds of weight was in.
Phil Berger.
He liked a dead ball. That is a kind of ball that would hit the rim and die. He hated the rebounder's ball. You know, rebounders love a ball that comes flying off because it's way up in the air, and who gets the ball but the guy that can soar for it. So basketballs can be all kinds of consistencies within a certain prescribed range. So he would go through the balls and pick out the one that was his ball. And I remember one playoff game against the Bullets. Somebody sneaked in a rebounder's ball, and he went crazy, screaming at the refs. When he'd scream, he'd get the veins in his neck would start popping out. He'd get red in his forehead and face. And he was very disturbed that they'd sneaked in a live rabbity ball. So he hollered loud enough and long enough so they brought back that dead ball that he liked.
But sometimes yelling wasn't enough. Marv Albert.
One referee once told me, and it was during a Nick Bullitt playoff series, Bradley wasn't satisfied with the way the basketball felt. He felt there was too much air in it, and he complained about it, and they didn't take heed. And then in the second half, he was spotted with one of those little devices that you take air out of the ball and pump air in, and he tried to sneak it out. He tried to let air out of the basketball so no one would see. This is our U.S. Senator Bill Bradley.
He had kind of a zany sense of humor, you know, impish kind of thing. He'd do like crazy things, like one day come down an elevator, and I think it was in San Diego, wearing a mask, you know, so nobody would recognize him. And he'd do crazy things. I think he went to a Dade DeBusschere party once at DeBusschere's house, turned his collar around, made me believe he was a priest, you know, things like that.
Is there an injustice in history's picture of the 69-70 Knicks? Phil Berger remembers guard Dick Barnett.
Four jerseys from that team hang from the starters, the other four starters, Frazier, Bradley, DeBusschere, and Reed. And to my mind, it's an injustice that Barnett's isn't there, because he really gave the team a hell of a dimension on defense. He often played the toughest guys, a la Jerry West, and could hit the clutch shots, that little junkyard jump shot of his. He banged him home at some key moments with two or three guys hanging on him and falling, reeling six steps backwards after he threw it up. It was an amazing shot, and he had an uncanny knack of hitting big baskets.
And just shows you how good Barnett was. Invariably, Red would put Barnett on the tougher guard. Like, Barnett would play Jerry West a lot, because Barnett was the smarter player and could play real good defense. But you didn't really notice that he was doing the damage, but Red knew it.
Red Holzman.
He was the guy that was a great shooter and played the tough guys defensively, you know, and very, very smart, which was the thing, you know. and loved to play basketball and just was perfect for us.
Walt Frazier shared the backcourt with Dick Barnett.
Dick was a great shooter. Once he got hot, he was the most exciting player to watch because he could make hook shots. I mean, he would make every shot in the book. And he was a guy that I idolized because he was an older guy and he always kept his body fit. He stayed in shape. And, you know, Dick was noted for being a shooter. But like I say, when Red came to the team, Dick had to play some defense. And at his age, at the time, he was like 35, man. He did it.
Barnett's response?
Walt had the people that he was best matched up against, and I think I was best matched up against certain individuals. I think Walt was better in a team defensive scheme where he was free to roam, gamble. When people turned their head, when I ran other people into him, I think he was most outstanding under those conditions. I think my forte playing defense was one up, head on head, straight up. So I thought we both had a role to play, and particularly with the people behind us, everybody working in a synchronized manner.
People used to think only of Barnett's offense because he had the fallback baby jump shot and did not consider that he was one of the best defensive players in the game. He always drew the tougher assignment because Frazier was allowed to roam and do his act with the steals and being creative. And, of course, if he misplayed, you had Willis back to reject, or you had the Busher. It was a helping-type team. It was all team defense-oriented. But Barnett usually drew the Jerry Wests and the Oscar Robertsons and usually did a very good job. And he was a very smart player who didn't get the attention because he was very quiet. And all the ball players knew how smart he was. And as it turned out, I can recall going to him frequently for post-game comments. He would say the best things.
But quiet, thoughtful, workmanlike, even Dick Barnett had his moments.
Barnett one night scored, had 28, 38 points, some great amount of points. And the press came in and asked him. And he was very low-key, had a good game, did okay. And as soon as they left the room, he screamed out to his teammate, "I was a monster! I was a monster!" You know, which again, you know, typifies his outlook. You know, to the press, he was going to keep the lids down, the shutters down. But once they left and he was with the team, you know, then he'd be much more expressive and be kind of the quintessential Barnett that the players liked.
Dick Barnett, he had a pool hustler's mind. I don't know what his total background was when he was growing up, but if you're looking for a guy to play a pool hustler, it would be Dick Barnett. Very sharp. And that's why he played basketball. That's the reason why not too many people appreciate how good he was. Most people, they relate to flash. Clyde was flashier than Barnett. But Barnett did solid things and very smart. It's one of the reasons why Red Holzman made him assistant coach when he retired.
But when fans remember Barnett, they talk about what Phil Berger called that junkyard jump shot of his. Hardly orthodox, highly effective.
Necessity is the mother of invention, and it was just one of those situations that I learned how to execute that shot on the playground without really knowing what I was doing. But fortunately, I was successful doing it, and my coaches at the high school level did not attempt to change my particular style, and I continued to do it. But if you know about basketball, basically, my shot, I wasn't doing anything different than anybody else except kicking my legs, which I guess is rather unique. But from the waist on up, in terms of shooting the ball, it's really just like everyone else.
In the backcourt, the Knicks had strength, and they had style.
Walt Clyde Frazier, I think, had three or four of the greatest years that anyone has had in the game. Now, there are critics out of town who would say, well, he played in New York, so he got the exposure. Now, certainly helped him. He was the right guy for this town and the time with the image. And, you know, he did not discourage people coming to his very flamboyant apartment and taking pictures on his huge round bed. And, hey, that's great. That's the game. It's entertainment. It's sports. But he was able to back things up.
Red Holzman.
Well, Frazier was special because besides being able to think, and he had the physical qualities, you know, and he had the quickness and he had the anticipation defensively, you know, This the kind of stuff that I asked these guys to do was right up his alley.
Matching up with Frazier and the Knicks could be a headache. Celtics guard JoJo White had to switch off to bail out teammate Don Chaney.
Chaney, for some reason or another, had a problem, you know, guarding Frazier because of the physicalness in which he played. And Frazier, on the other hand, likes somebody who's trying to play physical. That way he can, you know exactly where they are all the time. So it created a problem for Chaney. So I took my hand at guarding Frazier, which meant once the ball was in transition that it was tough getting back to another man, which meant he had to guard me. So I had the quickness versus, you know, his size and this type of thing. So we had advantages both ways.
The 69-70 season was the time for Walt Frazier to come into his own.
It was like someone had taken a veil off my eyes when I was on the court. I was seeing everything, and I was doing the things that I did in college. But at that point, I wasn't ready to say that they were there to stay. You know, I knew I still had trouble with Wes and Oscar, the guys that were better in the league. So at that point, I was still trying to improve my game, even though I thought that I was beginning to be on a par with those guys. And people were telling me that, but I didn't let that go to my head. Because that summer I worked harder than I ever did.
Larry Merchant.
He was one of those rare players who not only loved to talk about the game, but remembered virtually every detail of what went on in a game that's, you know, after all, it's up and down, it's hurly-burly, it's madcap, and he would remember virtually all of it.
He had a way of kind of resting during games where he would be very, if he went down in a collision, he'd be slow to get up. And he would kind of be resting, and he would always have kind of a cute comment to make about it, which was always picked up by the writers. But what he did on the court, you got the feeling he could do anything he wanted in his casual fashion.
I used to get knocked down, and Red would run on the court and say once sometimes, stay down, give the big guys a chance to rest, you know. So then it became a habit. Whenever I got knocked down, I would just take my time getting up, and it became one of my, you know, calling cards on the court, I guess. Whenever I got knocked down, people would wonder, is he going to get up?
Off the court, Frazier didn't spend much time with his NBA partners.
I never got too friendly with any players in the NBA, especially guards, because I found I kind of held back rather than playing my normal game. You have a tendency to not want to, you know, try to show them up. Most of my relationship with other players was high and by. I never got too close to any of them, you know, they were just associates.
The lineup of individuals went deeper than the starting five. The first guard off the bench was Mike Reardon. Marv Albert.
Reardon was one of these guys, also a terrific guy, who, being a local kid, he grew up in the New York area and then went out of town to college and was an overachiever in college and with the pros, who couldn't believe that all this was going on around him, and he was part of it. He was the type of guy who could step away and then look at it and say, God, I can't believe that I'm Mike Reardon with the New York Knicks, who won a championship, and we're going through this and the city is going crazy over us, which was nice. A lot of athletes are not able to do that.
Reardon didn't get a lot of minutes in his rookie season of 1968-69, but he did have an important role with the Knicks.
A team would have so many fouls before it got into the bonus situation or into the penalty situation. And it was very important, for instance, if the penalty situation took over with 2 minutes to go in a quarter, and there was 3.5 minutes left, and let's say the penalty was on the fifth foul, and if the team had only two fouls on it, it was three away from the penalty. So what a team would do was you trade, and at that time you only shot one free throw. So I would go into a game and deliberately try to strip the ball from somebody or try to go for a steal, but if I couldn't get the steal, I would try to foul them. And in this process, in either way, we would come out with something good. I'd either get a steal or get it cause a turnover, or the other team would wind up shooting one free throw. So the design of the play was we would go down the other end to try to get two, and the other team could only get one. So that obviously was changed later on. But it was a good strategy. It was a two-for-one strategy, and you tried to protect the guys that were in the game who were going to be playing a lot of minutes, like Frazier and Barnett. So you didn't want them to do it. They would bring me in for a couple minutes at a time to accomplish this.
The trio of Reardon, Cassie Russell, and Dave Stallworth were a key to the way the Knicks played.
The first thing was to make sure that when we got in the game and if the first team had a lead, that we would at least hold that lead or increase it. We didn't want to get them backed up. We didn't want to go in and make a slew of mistakes where the regulars would have to get back in the game and play catch-up basketball. So if we, if the first team was enjoying a particular lead, we would try to build upon it. We would try to keep the pressure on. We would try to get comfortable in the game ourselves so that in the second half we would be better prepared to play also. If we were down at the time we got into the game, we would try to change the direction or the pace of the game so that it wouldn't continue the way it was going. If we were down 10 or 12 points and the Minutemen would get in the game, and we saw that the slower pattern need to be hyped up, we would change the flow of the game so we could fast break a little bit more, or we would try to pick up the tempo because we knew at that pace we were not going to win that night.
Cassie Russell was the leader of this mini squad, and they had a name for themselves.
We kind of named ourselves the Minutemen because we got in, and like one coach used to say, I'm not worried too much about the starters. I'm worried about what those subs do when they come in.
Cassie holds the ball, looks at the clock, 17 seconds to go. Russell got it very closely by Johnny Green. Cassie along the right sideline, 10 seconds to go, cannot find an open man. Russell to the head of the foul circle, jumps and hits. He hit it, and the Knicks lead, 110-109.
We really gave you something to worry about because you look at a guy like Dave Stallworth and Mike Reardon and myself, we could run the floor pretty good. We were fairly decent shooters, and we knew what our roles were. So Red had a lot of confidence in us.
Cassie Russell was a favorite of mine because I felt that he took the type of jump shots that were perfect yes baskets.
Yes, yes, yes!
Because there were line drive shots. It was a trajectory that would kind of hit the back of the rim and then plop down. A very dramatic type shooter. One of the great shooters of that time. And, in fact, Cassie is one who does imitations of announcers, and he always had the yes down very well. In fact, I saw him a couple of weeks ago out in the West. He's coaching a CBA team in Wyoming, and someone tapped me on the shoulder, and I turn around, and he goes, yes, and it counts. He still has it. He still does. He has stationery that says yes.
To Cassie Russell, staying in shape was a matter of pride.
When I was at Michigan, I ran myself down so much that one year I was very, very sick. I had a little case of mono and a little strep throat, and I had really run myself down. And I had 103 temperature, and we were 13-0, and our last game was against Ohio State, and we had a chance to become the second team in the Big Ten history to go undefeated. I got sick that night, and I couldn't sweat, couldn't do anything. And so I had really dropped about 10 pounds. It really got thin, and so I decided at that time that I was going to go on health foods and eat a lot of baked and broiled foods and give up a lot of fried foods. And that's when I started.
John Condon.
I used to have a thing with Cassie Russell. He's a great vitamin freak. He swallows vitamins, I think, 52 at a time, he told me. And I'm a vitamin guy myself, but I don't swallow that many. And when he was going into the game, we would talk vitamins. He'd be kneeling down in front of me. We'd talk about vitamins. Sometime the horn would blow, and he'd forget about going in the game. We'd have to say, get in the game, Cassie.
Phil Berger.
He roomed with Dick Barnett, who called him Cockles and Muscles Russell. And he used to say that invitation to their hotel suite was by pharmaceuticals, prescription only. And Cassie always had something called the Wonder Wheel, which is some kind of instrument you use for building stomach muscles, and that was always on the road with him. I once he cared about being physically fit. I mean, it was a pleasure and a passion of his. I went one night to the 92nd Street Y with him and worked out. We shot baskets and ran on the track, and he loved doing it. He took a real pleasure in being physically fit and in doing all the rituals of being fit, running, sit-ups, so on and so forth. And then he'd take his shower, and he'd put on all the lotions and potions afterwards. His locker was filled with it. It looked like sort of Dwayne Reed discount center.
The first glimpse Garden fans got of Russell was in his classic matchup with Bill Bradley in the 1964 Holiday Festival. John Condon, as always, was there.
And I said to myself, And I never said this before, by the way. I said to myself, the real pro on that floor is Cassie Russell. Bradley is a great player, but the real pro on that floor is Cassie Russell. He turned out to be a great pro.
The professional rivalry between Bradley and Russell persisted even when they teamed up on the Knicks.
There was a lot of controversy between he and Cassie's who should start. Cassie was a more talented player, but Bill was better for the starting five because the ingredient that he brought, he gave us movement and he moved the ball, he kept in motion. But one-on-one, he couldn't get a shot off by himself, and we knew that, so we structured plays where he could get open and use that running around until guys got tired, and then that's when Bill would make his points.
Bill Bradley.
It never became personal, but it was a rivalry, as there are always rivalries when there are a limited number of slots on a starting team. And I think that the result of the rivalry was that we both played to our maximum ability, and the beneficiary was the team as a whole. There were many times when Cassie came in that he gave the team an enormous lift. And coming to appreciate the contribution that somebody can make coming off the bench or from a starting position, and recognizing that both of those contributions were central to the success of the team, I think was a maturing process, certainly for me.
Leonard Lewin.
It became very intense at one time and almost disrupted the team. And frankly, what Red Holzman discovered eventually was that Bradley could not come off the bench as well as Cassie could. In fact, Cassie was instant offense. Bradley couldn't do that. So what Red had to do was, for the benefit of the team, was to put Bradley stardom, and you use Cassie as the best way you can contribute. Maximum was coming off the bench and contributing instant offense. That happened. What helped Red make that decision, that transition, which wasn't easy, because there were a lot of people who were rapping it and, you know, criticizing it constantly, was that Cassie broke his ankle. And that gave Red the opening to use Bradley consistently.
Phil Berger on Russell's reaction.
Oh, it bothered him. He had the strong ego that all athletes have, and he would have loved to have been the starter and been the star. And what he had was the quintessential sixth man role, come off the bench and bang home three or four in a row, and he did that an awful lot. He was a terrific Frank Ramsey style player, but he always had that kind of larger than life sense of himself, and it got mixed reviews from his teammates. On the one hand, he was such a strong personality that he was definitely part of the team. But on the other hand, there was sometimes amusement about the way he was. I can remember in the playoffs against Milwaukee, he came down on two dunks and missed both of them. And I looked to the bench and the players were rolling as if, you know, they were at a Las Vegas lounge and their favorite comic was working. I mean, they were falling all over each other.
The Knicks were a team of individuals, but they were driven hard by a tough disciplinarian and coach Red Holzman.
It was not a loving relationship. There was a lot of kind of interpersonal tension between them sometimes. The players thought that he had an ego problem with dealing with them. They were getting tremendous publicity, and some of them said that that his contribution, his major contribution, was the installation of the defense, the doubling defense, and that. Aside from that, a lot of the contributions on offense came from guys like DeBuscher and Bradley. DeBuscher, who had been a former coach, Bradley, who was a very heady ball player. So there was not, it wasn't, but you know, the nature of a player-coach relationship, I guess, is always somewhat uneasy, and that existed.
Dick Barnett.
One of his greatest assets was defense. And also having the capacity to recognize veteran people on the club that could make a contribution. He was open to suggestions, and he was open to working with the veterans on the ball club. And I think with a complement of younger players, the veterans, you know, putting in what they could to help the system go. And with Red's overall approach, I think it turned us into a winning combination.
As individuals, the Knicks were as different as could be. On the floor, they were a team.
I think it was just about like any other team. You have different personalities. You have different individuals. Some guys like to read books. Others like to go to movies. Others like to do other things. It was just a consortium of individuals who had a common talent and a common goal to be successful in what they were doing, and had profound confidence in what we were doing.
Bill Bradley.
I think the team looked at each other in terms of individual human beings, and I think it was a remarkable group of human beings. And we were friends, but at the same time, we gave each other the space needed for independence. And above all, we came together on the court and complemented each other's abilities, because we realized that if we all pulled together, that we would do a lot more than if we went our separate ways.
You can't underestimate the role New York fans played in those championship seasons. We'll talk about them next.
Every city loves a winner. But there was something particularly profound about the relationship between the Knicks teams of the late 60s and early 70s and the fans who listened to games on the radio, watched on TV, and if they were lucky enough to score a ticket, cheer the team on at Madison Square Garden. The story of the sixth man, the fans, next time on Episode 5 of the New York Knicks, those championship seasons. Thanks for listening. I'm Bud Mishkin.